They Do It With Mirrors by Agatha Christie. Read by Rosemary Leach. Chapter 1. Mrs. Van Rydock moved a little back from the mirror and sighed. "Well, that'll have to do," she murmured. "Think it's all right, Jane?" Miss Marple eyed the Lanvanelli creation appraisingly. "It seems to me a very beautiful gown," she said.
"Well, the gown's all right," said Mrs. Van Rydock, and sighed. "Take it off, Stephanie," she said.
The elderly maid with the grey hair and the small pinched mouth eased the gown carefully up over Mrs. Van Rydock's upstretched arms. Mrs. Van Rydock stood in front of the glass in her peach satin slip. She was exquisitely corseted. Her still shapely legs were encased in fine nylon stockings. Her face, beneath a layer of cosmetics and constantly toned up by massage, appeared almost girlish at a slight distance. Her hair was less grey than tending to hydrangea blue, and was perfectly set. It was practically impossible when looking at Mrs. Van Rydock to imagine what she would be like in a natural state. Everything that money could do had been done for her, reinforced by diet, massage, and constant exercises. Ruth Van Rydock looked humorously at her friend. "Do you think most people would guess, Jane, that you and I are practically the same age?" Miss Marple responded loyally. "Oh, not for a moment, I'm sure," she said reassuringly. "I'm afraid, you know, that I look every minute of my age." Miss Marple was white-haired, with a soft pink and white wrinkled face and innocent china-blue eyes. She looked a very sweet old lady. Nobody would have called Mrs. Van Rydock a sweet old lady. "I guess you do, Jane," said Mrs. Van Rydock. She grinned suddenly. "And so do I, only not in the same way. Wonderful how that old hag keeps her figure. That's what they say of me. But they know I'm an old hag, all right. And my God, do I feel like one." She dropped heavily onto the satin quilted chair. "That's all right, Stephanie," she said. "You can go." Stephanie gathered up the dress and went out. "Good old Stephanie," said Ruth Van Rydock. "She's been with me for over 30 years now. She's the only woman who knows what I really look like. Jane, I want to talk to you." Miss Marple leant forward a little. Her face took on a receptive expression. She looked somehow an incongruous figure in the ornate bedroom of the expensive hotel suite. She was dressed in rather dowdy black, carried a large shopping bag, and looked every inch a lady. "I'm worried, Jane, about Carrie Louise."
"Carrie Louise?" Miss Marple repeated the name musingly. The sound of it took her a long way back. The pensionnat in Florence. Herself, the pink and white English girl from a cathedral close. The two Martin girls, Americans, exciting to the English girl because of their quaint ways of speech and their forthright manner and vitality. Ruth, tall, eager, on top of the world. Carrie Louise, small, dainty, wistful.
"When did you see her last, Jane?"
"Oh, not for many, many years. It must be 25 at least. Of course, we still send cards at Christmas." Such an odd thing, friendship. She, young Jane Marple, and the two Americans. Their ways diverging almost at once, and yet the old affection persisting. Occasional letters, remembrances at Christmas. Strange that Ruth, whose home, or rather homes, had been in America, should be the sister whom she had seen the more often of the two. No, perhaps not strange. Like most Americans of her class, Ruth had been cosmopolitan. Every year or two she had come over to Europe, rushing from London to Paris, on to the Riviera and back again, and always keen to snatch a few moments wherever she was with her old friends. There had been many meetings like this one, in Claridge's, or the Savoy, or the Berkeley, or the Dorchester. A recherché meal, affectionate reminiscences, and a hurried and affectionate goodbye. Ruth had never had time to visit St. Mary Mead. Miss Marple had not, indeed, ever expected it. Everyone's life has a tempo. Ruth's was presto, whereas Miss Marple's was adagio.
So it was American Ruth whom she'd seen the most of, whereas Carrie Louise, who lived in England, she'd not seen now for over 20 years. Odd, but quite natural, because when one lives in the same country, there's no need to arrange meetings with old friends. One assumes that sooner or later one will see them without contrivance. Only if you move in different spheres, that does not happen. The paths of Jane Marple and Carrie Louise did not cross. It was as simple as that. "Why are you worried about Carrie Louise, Ruth?" asked Miss Marple. "In a way, that's what worries me most. I just don't know. She's not ill?" "Well, she's very delicate, always has been. I wouldn't say she'd been any worse than usual, considering that she's getting on just as we all are."
"Unhappy?"
"Oh, no."
No, it wouldn't be that, thought Miss Marple. It would be difficult to imagine Carrie Louise unhappy. And yet there were times in her life when she must have been. Only, the picture did not come clearly. Bewildered, yes. Incredulous, yes. But violent grief, no.
Mrs. Van Rydock's words came appositely. "Carrie Louise," she said, "has always lived right out of this world. She doesn't know what it's like. Maybe it's that that worries me."
"Her circumstances," began Miss Marple, then stopped, shaking her head. "No," she said.
"No, it's she herself," said Ruth Van Rydock. "Carrie Louise has always been the one of us who had ideals. Of course, it was the fashion when we were young to have ideals. We all had them. It was the proper thing for young girls. You were going to nurse lepers, Jane, and I was going to be a nun. One gets over all that nonsense. Marriage, I suppose, one might say, knocks it out of one. Still, take it by and large, I haven't done badly out of marriage."
Miss Marple thought that Ruth was expressing it mildly.
Ruth had been married 3 times, each to an extremely wealthy man, and the resultant divorces had increased her bank balance without in the least souring her disposition. "Of course," said Mrs. Van Rydock, "I've always been tough. Things don't get me down. I've not expected too much of life, and certainly not expected too much of men. And I've done very well out of it, and no hard feelings. Tommy and I are still excellent friends, and Julius often asks me my opinion about the market."
Her face darkened. "I believe that's what worries me most about Carrie Louise. She's always had a tendency, you know, to marry cranks."
"Cranks?"
"People with ideals. Carrie Louise was always a pushover for ideals. There she was, as pretty as they make 'em, just 17, and listening with her eyes big as saucers to old Gulbranson holding forth about his plans for the human race. 50, and she married him, a widower with a family of grown-up children, all because of his philanthropic ideas. She used to sit listening to him spellbound, just like Desdemona and Othello. Only fortunately there was no Iago about to mess things up. And anyway, Gulbranson wasn't colored. He was a Swede or a Norwegian or something."
Miss Marple nodded thoughtfully. The name of Gulbranson had an international significance. A man who, with a shrewd business acumen and perfect honesty, had built up a fortune so colossal that really philanthropy had been the only solution to the disposal of it. The name still held significance. The Gulbranson Trust, the Gulbranson Research Fellowships, the Gulbranson Administrative Almshouses, and best known of all, the vast educational college for the sons of working men.
"She didn't marry him for his money, you know," said Ruth. "I should have, if I'd married him at all, but not Carrie Louise. I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't died when she was 32. 32 is a very nice age for a widow. She's got experience, but she's still adaptable."
The spinster, listening to her, nodded gently while her mind revived tentatively widows she had known in the village of St. Mary Mead. "I was really happiest about Carrie Louise when she was married to Johnny Resterick. Of course, he married her for her money. Or, if not exactly that, at any rate, he wouldn't have married her if she hadn't had any. Johnny was a selfish, pleasure-loving, lazy hound. But that is so much safer than a crank. All Johnny wanted was to live soft. He wanted Carrie Louise to go to the best dressmakers and have yachts and cars and enjoy herself with them. That kind of man is so very safe. Give him comfort and luxury and he'll purr like a cat and be absolutely charming to you. I never took that scene designing and theatrical stuff of his very seriously, but Carrie Louise was thrilled by it. Saw it all as art with a capital A. And really forced him back into those surroundings. And then that dreadful Yugoslavian woman got hold of him and just swept him off with her. He really didn't want to go. If Carrie Louise had waited and been sensible, he'd have come back to her. "Did she care very much?" asked Miss Marple. "That's the funny thing. I don't believe she really did. Oh, she was absolutely sweet about it all. But then she would be. She is sweet. Quite anxious to divorce him so that he and that creature could get married, and offering to give those two boys of his by his first marriage a home with her because it would be more settled for them. So there poor Johnny was. He had to marry the woman, and she led him an awful 6 months and then drove him over a precipice in a car in a fit of rage. They said it was an accident, but I think it was just temper." Mrs. Van Rydock paused, took up a mirror, and gazed at her face searchingly. She picked up her eyebrow tweezers and pulled out a hair. "And what does Carrie Louise do next but marry this man, Louis Sirricold? Another crank. Another man with ideals. Oh, I don't say he isn't devoted to her. I think he is. But he's bitten by that same bug of wanting to improve everybody's lives for them. And really, you know, nobody can do that but yourself." "I wonder," said Miss Marple. "Only, of course, there's a fashion in these things, just like there is in clothes. My dear, have you seen what Christian Dior is trying to make us wear in the way of skirts? Where was I? Oh, yes, fashion. Well, there's a fashion in philanthropy, too. It used to be education in Gulbranson's day, but that's out of date now. The state has stepped in. Everyone expects education as a matter of right, and doesn't think much of it when they get it. Juvenile delinquency, that's what the rage is nowadays. All these young criminals and potential criminals. Everyone's mad about them. You should see Louis Sirricold's eyes sparkle behind those thick glasses of his. Crazy with enthusiasm. One of those men with enormous willpower who like living on a banana and a piece of toast and put all their energies into a cause. And Carrie Louise eats it up, just as she always did. But I don't like it, Jane. They've had meetings of the trustees, and the whole place has been turned over to this new idea. It's a training establishment now for these juvenile criminals, complete with psychiatrists and psychologists and all the rest of it. There, Louis and Carrie Louise are living there, surrounded by these boys who aren't perhaps quite normal. And the place stiff with occupational therapists and teachers and enthusiasts, half of them quite mad. Cranks, all a lot of them. And my poor little Carrie Louise in the middle of it all. She paused and stared helplessly at Miss Marple. Miss Marple said in a faintly puzzled voice, "But you haven't told me yet, Ruth, what you're really afraid of." "I tell you, I don't know. And that's what worries me. I've just been down there for a flying visit, and I felt all along that there was something wrong. In the atmosphere in the house, I know I'm not mistaken. I'm sensitive to atmosphere, always have been. Did I ever tell you how I urged Julius to sell out of Amalgamated Cereals before the crash came, and wasn't I right? Yes, something is wrong down there, and I don't know why or what. If it's these dreadful young jailbirds, or if it's near a home. I can't say what it is. There's Louis just living for his ideas and not noticing anything else, and Carrie Louise, bless her, never seeing or hearing or thinking anything except what's a lovely sight or a lovely sound or a lovely thought. It's sweet, but it isn't practical.
there is such a thing as evil. And I want you, Jane, to go down there right away and find out just exactly what's the matter."
"Me?" exclaimed Miss Marple. "Why me?"
"Because you've got a nose for that sort of thing. You always had. You've always been a sweet, innocent-looking creature, Jane, and all the time underneath, nothing has ever surprised you. You always believe the worst."
"Well, the worst is so often true," murmured Miss Marple.
"Why you have such a poor idea of human nature, I can't think, living in that sweet, peaceful village of yours, so old-world and pure.
You've never lived in a village, Ruth. The things that go on in a pure, peaceful village would probably surprise you."
"Oh, I dare say. My point is, they don't surprise you. So you will go down to Stony Gates and find out what's wrong, won't you?"
"But, Ruth, dear, that would be a most difficult thing to do."
"No, it wouldn't. I thought it all out. If you won't be absolutely mad at me, I've prepared the ground already."
Mrs. Van Rydock paused, eyed Miss Marple rather uneasily, lighted a cigarette, and plunged rather nervously into an explanation.
"Oh, you'll admit, I'm sure, that things have been difficult in this country since the war for people with small fixed incomes. For people like you, that is to say, Jane."
"Oh, yes, indeed. But for the kindness, the really great kindness of my nephew Raymond, I don't know really where I should be."
"Never mind your nephew," said Mrs. Van Rydock. "Carrie Louise knows nothing about your nephew, or if she does, she knows him as a writer and has no idea that he's your nephew. The point, as I put it to Carrie Louise, is that it's just too bad about dear Jane. Really, sometimes hardly enough to eat, and, of course, far too proud ever to appeal to old friends. One couldn't, I said, suggest money, but a nice long rest and lovely surroundings with an old friend and with plenty of nourishing food and no cares or worries and..." Ruth Van Rydock paused and then added defiantly, "Now, go on. Be mad at me if you want to be."
Miss Marple opened her china blue eyes in gentle surprise. "But why should I be mad at you, Ruth? A very ingenious and plausible approach. I'm sure Carrie Louise responded."
"She's writing to you. You'll find the letter when you get back. Honestly, Jane, you don't feel I've taken an unpardonable liberty. You won't mind..."
She hesitated, and Miss Marple put her thoughts deftly into words. "Going to Stony Gates as an object of charity? More or less under false pretenses? Oh, not in the least. If it is necessary..." "You think it is necessary? And I'm inclined to agree with you." Mrs. Van Rydock stared at her.
"But why? And what have you heard?"
"No, I haven't heard anything. It's just your conviction. You're not a fanciful woman, Ruth."
"No, but I haven't anything definite to go upon."
"I remember," said Miss Marple thoughtfully, "one Sunday morning at church. It was the second Sunday in Advent. Sitting behind Grace Lamble and feeling more and more worried about her, quite sure, you know, that something was wrong, badly wrong, and yet being quite unable to say why. A most disturbing feeling and very, very definite."
"And was there something wrong?"
"Oh, yes. Her father, the old admiral, had been very peculiar for some time, and the very next day he went for her with the coal hammer, roaring out that she was Antichrist masquerading as his daughter. He nearly killed her. They took him away to the asylum, and she eventually recovered after months in hospital, but it was a very near thing."
"And you'd actually had a premonition that day in church?"
"Well, I wouldn't call it a premonition. It was founded on fact. I mean, these things usually are, though one doesn't always recognize it at the time. She was wearing her Sunday hat the wrong way round. Very significant, really, because Grace Lamble was a most precise woman, not at all vague or absent-minded, and the circumstances under which she would not notice which way her hat was put on to go to church were really extremely limited. Her father, you see, had thrown a marble paperweight at her, and it had shattered the looking-glass. She'd caught up her hat, put it on, and hurried out of the house, anxious to keep up appearances and for the servants not to hear anything. She put down these actions, you see, to dear Papa's naval temper. She didn't realize that his mind was definitely unhinged. Though she ought to have realized it clearly enough. He was always complaining to her of being spied upon, and of enemies, all the usual symptoms, in fact. Mrs. Van Rydock gazed respectfully at her friend.
"Maybe, Jane," she said, "that St. Mary Mead of yours isn't quite the idyllic retreat that I've always imagined it."
"Human nature, dear, is very much the same everywhere. It is more difficult to observe it closely in a city, that's all."
"And you'll go to Stony Gates?"
"I'll go to Stony Gates. A little unfair, perhaps, on my nephew Raymond. To let it be thought that he does not assist me, I mean. Still, the dear boy is in Mexico for 6 months. By that time it should be all over."
"What should be all over?"
"Well, Carrie Louise's invitation will hardly be for an indefinite stay. 3 weeks, perhaps, a month. That should be ample."
"For you to find out what's wrong?"
"For me to find out what is wrong."
"My Jane," said Mrs. Van Rydock, "you've got a lot of confidence in yourself, haven't you?"
Miss Marple looked faintly reproachful. "You have confidence in me, Ruth, or so you say. I can only assure you that I shall endeavour to justify your confidence."
Chapter 2. Before catching her train back to St. Mary Mead, Wednesday's special cheap day return, Miss Marple, in a precise and businesslike fashion, collected certain data. "Carrie Louise and I have corresponded after a fashion, but it has largely been a matter of Christmas cards or calendars. It's just the facts I should like, Ruth dear, and also some idea as to whom exactly I shall encounter in the household at Stony Gates."
"Well, you know all about Carrie Louise's marriage to Gulbranson. There were no children, and Carrie Louise took that very much to heart. Gulbranson was a widower and had 3 grown-up sons. Eventually, they adopted a child. Pippa, they called her. Lovely little creature. She was just 2 years old when they got her."
"Where did she come from? What was her background?"
"Oh, really now, Jane, I can't remember, if I ever heard, that is. An adoption society, maybe? Or some unwanted child that Gulbranson had heard about?
Why?
Do you think that's important?"
"Well, one always likes to know the background, so to speak. But please, go on."
"Well, the next thing that happened was that Carrie Louise found that she was going to have a baby after all. I understand from doctors that that quite often happens."
Miss Marple nodded. "I believe so."
"Anyway, it did happen. And in a funny kind of way. Carrie Louise was almost disconcerted, if you can understand what I mean. Earlier, of course, she'd have been wild with joy. As it was, she'd given such a devoted love to Pippa that she felt quite apologetic to Pippa for putting her nose out of joint, so to speak. And then Mildred, when she was arrived, was really a very unattractive child. Took after the Gilbransons, who were solid and worthy, but definitely homely. Carrie Louise was always so anxious to make no difference between the adopted child and her own child that I think she rather tended to overindulge Pippa and pass over Mildred. And sometimes I think Mildred resented it. However, I didn't see them often. Pippa grew up a very beautiful girl, and Mildred grew up a plain one. Eric Gulbranson died when Mildred was 15 and Pippa 18. At 20, Pippa married an Italian, the Marchese di San Severiano. Oh, quite a genuine Marchese, not an adventurer or anything like that. She was by way of being an heiress. Well, naturally, or San Severiano wouldn't have had married her. You know what the Italians are. Gulbranson left an equal sum in trust for both his own and his adopted daughter. And Mildred married a Cannon Street. A nice man, but given to colds in the head. about 10 or 15 years older than she was. Quite a happy marriage, I believe. Well, he died a year ago, and Mildred has come back to Stonegates to live with her mother. Yeah, but that's getting on too fast. I've skipped a marriage or two. I'll go back to them. Now, Pippa married her Italian. Carrie Louise was quite pleased about the marriage. Guido had beautiful manners and was very handsome, and he was a fine sportsman. A year later, Pippa had a daughter and died in childbirth. That was a terrible tragedy, and Guido Sanseveriano was very cut up. Carrie Louise went to and fro between Italy and England a good deal, and it was in Rome that she met Johnny Resterich and married him. The Marchese married again, and he was quite willing for his little daughter to be brought up in England by her exceedingly wealthy grandmother. So they all settled down at Stonegates, Johnny Resterich and Carrie Louise, and Johnny's two boys, Alexis and Stephen. Johnny's first wife was a Russian, and the baby, Gina. Now, Mildred married her canon soon afterwards. Then came all this business of Johnny and the Yugoslavian woman and the divorce. The boys still came to Stonegates for their holidays and were devoted to Carrie Louise. And then in 1938, I think it was, Carrie Louise married Lewis. Mrs. Van Rydock paused for breath. "You've not met Lewis?" Miss Marple shook her head. "No, I think I last saw Carrie Louise in 1928. She very sweetly took me to Covent Garden, to the opera." "Oh, yes. Well, Lewis was a very suitable person for her to marry. He was the head of a very celebrated firm of chartered accountants. I think he met her first over some questions of the finances of the Gulbranson Trust and the college. He was well off, just about her own age, and a man of absolutely upright life, but he was a crank. He was absolutely rabid on the subject of the redemption of young criminals." Ruth Van Rydock sighed. "Well, as I said just now, Jane, there are fashions in philanthropy. In Gulbranson's time, it was education. Before that, it was soup kitchens." Miss Marple nodded. "Oh, yes, indeed. Port wine jelly and calves head broth taken to the sick. My mother used to do it." "Well, that's right. Feeding the body gave way to feeding the mind. Everyone went mad on educating the lower classes. Well, that's past. Soon I expect the fashionable thing will be not to educate your children and preserve their illiteracy carefully until they're 18. Anyway, the Gulbranson Trust and the Education Fund was in some difficulties because the state was taking over its functions. Then Lewis came along with his passionate enthusiasm about constructive training for juvenile delinquents. His attention had been drawn to the subject first in the course of his profession, auditing accounts where ingenious young men had perpetrated frauds. He was more and more convinced that juvenile delinquents were not subnormal, that they had excellent brains and abilities and only needed right direction." "Well, there is something in that," said Miss Marple. "But it is not entirely true. I remember..." She broke off and glanced at her watch. "Oh, dear, I mustn't miss the 6:30. Ruth Van Rydock said urgently, "And you will go to Stonegates?" Gathering up her shopping bag and her umbrella, Miss Marple said, "If Carrie Louise asks me..." "Oh, she will ask you. You'll go? You promise, Jane?" Jane Marple promised. Chapter 3 Miss Marple got out of the train at Market Kindle Station. A kindly fellow passenger handed out her suitcase after her, and Miss Marple, clutching a string bag, a faded leather handbag, and some miscellaneous wraps, uttered appreciative twitters of thanks. "Oh, so kind of you, I'm sure. So difficult nowadays. Not many porters. I get so flustered when I travel." The twitters were drowned by the booming noise of the station announcer saying loudly but indistinctly that the 318 was standing at Platform 1 and was about to proceed to various unidentifiable stations. Market Kindle was a large, empty, wind-swept station with hardly any passengers or railway staff to be seen on it. Its claim to distinction lay in having 6 platforms and a bay where a very small train of one carriage was puffing importantly.
Miss Marple, rather more shabbily dressed than was her custom, so lucky that she hadn't given away the old speckledy, was peering round her uncertainly when a young man came up to her. "Miss Marple," he said. His voice had an unexpectedly dramatic quality about it, as though the utterance of her name were the first words of a part he was playing in amateur theatricals. "I've come to meet you from Stonygates." Miss Marple looked gratefully at him. A charming, helpless-looking old lady with, if he had chanced to notice it, very shrewd blue eyes. The personality of the young man did not quite match his voice. It was less important, one might almost say insignificant. His eyelids had a trick of fluttering nervously. "Oh, thank you," said Miss Marple. "There's just this suitcase." She noticed that the young man did not pick up her suitcase himself. He flipped a finger at a porter who was trundling some packing cases past on a trolley. "Bring it out, please," he said, and added importantly, "for Stonygates." The porter said cheerfully, "Righty-o, shan't be long." Miss Marple fancied that her new acquaintance was not too pleased about this. It was as if Buckingham Palace had been dismissed as no more important than 3 Laburnum Road. He said, "The railways get more impossible every day." Guiding Miss Marple towards the exit, he said, "I'm Edgar Lawson. Mrs. Sericold asked me to meet you. I help Mr. Sericold in his work." There was again the faint insinuation that a busy and important man had very charmingly put important affairs on one side out of chivalry to his employer's wife. And again, the impression was not wholly convincing. It had a theatrical flavour. Miss Marple began to wonder about Edgar Lawson. They came out of the station, and Edgar guided the old lady to where a rather elderly Ford V8 was standing. He was just saying, "Will you come in front with me, or would you prefer the back?" when there was a diversion. A new, gleaming, 2-seater Rolls Bentley came purring into the station yard and drew up in front of the Ford. A very beautiful young woman jumped out of it and came across to them. The fact that she wore dirty corduroy slacks and a simple shirt open at the neck seemed somehow to enhance the fact that she was not only beautiful, but expensive. "Oh, there you are, Edgar. I thought I wouldn't make it in time. I see you've got Miss Marple. I came to meet her." She smiled dazzlingly at Miss Marple, showing a row of lovely teeth in a sunburnt southern face. "I'm Gina," she said, "Carrie Louise's granddaughter. What was your journey like? Simply foul? Oh, what a nice string bag. I love string bags. I'll take it and the coats, and then you can get in better." Edgar's face flushed. He protested, "Now look here, Gina. I came to meet Miss Marple. It was all arranged." Again the teeth flashed in that wide, lazy smile. "Oh, I know, Edgar, but I suddenly thought it would be nice if I came along. I'll take her with me, and you can wait and bring your cases up." She slammed the door on Miss Marple, ran round to the other side, jumped in the driving seat, and they purred swiftly out of the station. Looking back, Miss Marple noticed Edgar Lawson's face. "I don't think, my dear," she said, "that Mr. Lawson is very pleased." Gina laughed. "Edgar's a frightful idiot," she said, "always so pompous about things. You'd think he really mattered." Miss Marple asked, "Doesn't he matter?" "Edgar!" There was an unconscious note of cruelty in Gina's scornful laugh. "Oh, he's bats, anyway." "Bats?" "Well, they're all bats at Stonygates," said Gina. "I don't mean Lois and Grandam and me and the boys, and not Miss Bellever, of course, but the others. Well, sometimes I feel I'm going a bit bats myself living there. Even Aunt Mildred goes out on walks and mutters to herself the whole time. And you don't expect a canon's widow to do that, do you?" They swung out of station approach and accelerated up the smooth-surfaced empty road. Gina shot a swift sideways glance at her companion. "You were at school with Grandam, weren't you? It seems so queer." Miss Marple knew perfectly well what she meant. To youth it seems very odd to think that age was once young and pigtailed and struggled with decimals and English literature. "It must," said Gina with awe in her voice, and obviously not meaning to be rude, "have been a very long time ago." "Yes, indeed," said Miss Marple. "You feel that more with me than you do with your grandmother, I expect." Gina nodded. "It's cute of you saying that. Grandam, you know, gives one a curiously ageless feeling. It's a long time since I've seen her. I wonder if I shall find her much changed."
"Well, her hair's grey, of course," said Gina vaguely, "and she walks with a stick because of her arthritis. It's got much worse lately. I suppose that..." She broke off and then asked, "Have you been to Stonegate's before?"
"Well, no, never." "I've heard a great deal about it, of course."
"It's pretty ghastly, really," said Gina cheerfully. "A sort of Gothic monstrosity. What Steve calls best Victorian lavatory period. But it's fun, too, in a way. Only, of course, everything's madly earnest, and you tumble over psychiatrists everywhere underfoot, enjoying themselves madly. They're rather like scoutmasters, only worse. The young criminals are rather pet, some of them. One showed me how to diddle locks with a bit of wire, and one angelic-faced boy gave me a lot of points about coshing people." Miss Marple considered this information thoughtfully. "It's the thugs I like best," said Gina. "I don't fancy the queers so much. Of course, Lewis and Dr. Maverick think they're all queer. I mean, they think it's repressed desires and disordered home life and their mothers getting off with soldiers and all that. I don't really see it myself because some people have awful home lives and yet have managed to turn out quite all right." "I'm sure it's all a very difficult problem," said Miss Marple. Gina laughed, again showing her magnificent teeth. "Well, it doesn't worry me much. I suppose some people have these sort of urges to make the world a better place. Lewis is quite dibby about it all. He's going to Aberdeen next week because there's a case coming up in the police court, a boy with 5 previous convictions. The young man who met me at the station, Mr. Lawson, he helps Mr. Sericold, he told me. Is he his secretary?" "Oh, Edgar hasn't brains enough to be a secretary. He's a case, really. He used to stay at hotels and pretend he was a VC or a fighter pilot and borrow money and then do a flit. I think he's just a rotter. But Lewis goes through a routine with them all. Makes them feel one of the family and gives them jobs to do and all that to encourage their sense of responsibility. I dare say we shall all be murdered one of these days by one of them." Gina laughed merrily. Miss Marple did not laugh. They turned in through some imposing gates, where a commissionaire was standing on duty in a military manner, and drove up a drive flanked with rhododendrons. The drive was badly kept, and the ground seemed neglected. Interpreting her companion's glance, Gina said, "No gardeners during the war, and since we haven't bothered. But it does look rather terrible." They came round a curve, and Stonegate's appeared in its full glory. It was, as Gina had said, a vast edifice of Victorian Gothic, a kind of temple to plutocracy. Philanthropy had added to it in various wings and outbuildings, which, while not positively dissimilar in style, had robbed the structure as a whole of any cohesion or purpose. "Hideous, isn't it?" said Gina affectionately. "There's Grandam on the terrace. I'll stop here, and you can go and meet her." Miss Marple advanced along the terrace towards her old friend. From a distance, the slim little figure looked curiously girlish in spite of the stick on which she leaned and her slow and obviously rather painful progress. It was though a young girl was giving an exaggerated imitation of old age. "Jane," said Mrs. Sericold. "Dear Carrie Louise." Yes, unmistakably, Carrie Louise. Strangely unchanged. Strangely youthful still. Although, unlike her sister, she used no cosmetics or artificial aids to youth. Her hair was grey, but it had always been of a silvery fairness,
and the colour had changed very little. Her skin still had a rose-leaf pink and white appearance, though now it was a crumpled rose-leaf. Her eyes still had their starry, innocent glance. She had the slender, youthful figure of a girl, and her head kept its eager, bird-like tilt. "Oh, I do blame myself," said Carrie Louise in her sweet voice, "for letting it be so long. Oh, years since I saw you, Jane dear. It's just lovely that you've come at last to pay a visit here." From the end of the terrace, Gina called, "You ought to come in, Grandam. It's getting cold, and Jolly will be furious." Carrie Louise gave her little silvery laugh. "Oh, they all fuss about me so," she said. "They rub it in that I'm an old woman." "And you don't feel like one?" "No, I don't, Jane. In spite of all my aches and pains, and I've got plenty. Inside, I go on feeling just a chit, like Gina. Well, perhaps everyone does. The glass shows them how old they are, and they just don't believe it. It seems only a few months ago that we were at Florence. Oh, do you remember Fräulein Schweitsch and her boots?" The two elderly women laughed together at events that had happened nearly half a century ago. They walked together to a side door. In the doorway, a gaunt, elderly lady met them. She had an arrogant nose, a short haircut, and wore stout, well-cut tweeds. She said fiercely, "It's absolutely crazy of you, Cara, to stay out so late. You're absolutely incapable of taking care of yourself. Now, what will Mr. Serricold say?" "Oh, don't scold me, Jolly," said Carrie Louise pleadingly. She introduced Miss Bellever to Miss Marple. "Now, this is Miss Bellever, who is simply everything to me. Nurse, dragon, watchdog, secretary, housekeeper, and very faithful friend." Juliet Bellever sniffed, and the end of her big nose turned rather pink, a sign of emotion. "Well, I do what I can," she said gruffly. "This is a crazy household. We simply can't arrange any kind of planned routine." "But, darling Jolly, of course you can't. I wonder why you even try. Where are you putting Miss Marple?"
In the blue room. "Shall I take her up?" asked Miss Bellever.
"Yes, please do, Jolly, and then bring her down to tea. It's in the library today, I think." The blue room had heavy curtains of a rich, faded blue brocade that must have been, Miss Marple thought, about 50 years old. The furniture was mahogany, big and solid, and the bed was a vast mahogany four-poster. Miss Bellever opened the door into a connecting bathroom. This was unexpectedly modern, orchid in colouring, and with much dazzling chromium.
She observed grimly, "John Restrick had 10 bathrooms put into the house when he married Cara. The plumbing is about the only thing that's ever been modernized. He wouldn't hear of the rest being altered, so the whole place was a perfect period piece. Did you ever know him at all?"
"No, I never met him. Mrs. Serricold and I have met very seldom, though we've always corresponded."
"He was an agreeable fellow," said Miss Bellever. "No good, of course, complete rotter. But pleasant to have about the house. Great charm. Women liked him far too much, and that was his undoing in the end. Not really Cara's type." She added with a brusque resumption of her practical manner, "The housemaid will unpack for you. Do you want to wash before tea?"
Receiving an affirmative answer, she said that Miss Marple would find her waiting at the top of the stairs. Miss Marple went into the bathroom and washed her hands, and dried them a little nervously on a very beautiful orchid-coloured face towel. Then she removed her hat and patted her soft white hair into place. Opening her door, she found Miss Bellever waiting for her, and was conducted down the big, gloomy staircase and across a vast, dark hall and into a room where bookshelves went up to the ceiling and a big window looked out over an artificial lake. Carrie Louise was standing by the window, and Miss Marple joined her. "What an imposing house this is," said Miss Marple. "I feel quite lost in it." "Yes, I know. It's ridiculous, really. It was built by a prosperous iron master or something of that kind. He went bankrupt not long after, I don't wonder, really. There were about 14 living rooms, all enormous. I've never seen what people can want with more than one sitting room. All those huge bedrooms, such a lot of unnecessary space. I mean, mine is terribly overpowering. And quite a long way to walk from the bed to the dressing table. And great, heavy, dark crimson curtains. You haven't had it modernized and redecorated? Carrie Louise looked vaguely surprised. Oh, no. Well, on the whole, it's very much as it was when I first lived here with Eric. It's been repainted, of course, but they always do it the same color. Well, those things don't really matter, do they? I mean, I shouldn't have felt justified in spending a lot of money on that kind of thing when there are so many things that are so much more important. Have there been no changes at all in the house? Oh, yes, heaps of them. We've just kept a kind of block in the middle of the house as it was, the great hall and the rooms off and over. They're the best ones, and Johnny, my second husband, was lyrical over them and said they should never be touched or altered. And, of course, he was an artist and a designer, and he knew about these things. But the east and west wings have been completely remodeled. All the rooms partitioned off and divided up so that we have offices and bedrooms for the teaching staff and all that. The boys are all in the college building. You can see it from here. Miss Marple looked out towards where a large red brick building showed through a belt of sheltered trees. Then her eyes fell on something nearer at hand, and she smiled a little. Oh, what a very beautiful girl Gina is, she said. Carrie Louise's face lit up. Oh, yes, isn't she? She said softly. It's so lovely to have her back here again. I sent her to America at the beginning of the war, to Ruth. Did Ruth talk about her at all? No, at least she did just mention her. Carrie Louise sighed. Oh, poor Ruth. She was frightfully upset over Gina's marriage, but I've told her again and again I don't blame her in the least. I mean, Ruth doesn't realize, as I do, that the old barriers and class shibboleths are gone, or at any rate are going. Gina was doing her war work, and she met this young man. He was a Marine and had a very good war record. And a week later they were married. It was all far too quick, of course. No time to find out if they were really suited to each other. But that's the way of things nowadays. Young people belong to their generation. We may think they're unwise in many of their doings, but we have to accept their decisions. Oh, Ruth, though, was terribly upset. She didn't consider the young man suitable. Oh, she kept saying that one didn't know anything about him. But he came from the Middle West, and he hadn't any money, and naturally no profession. Well, there are hundreds of boys like that everywhere. But it wasn't Ruth's idea of what was right for Gina. However, the thing was done. I was so glad when Gina accepted my invitation to come over here with her husband. There's so much going on here. Jobs of every kind. And if Wanda wants to specialize in medicine or get a degree or anything, he could do it in this country. After all, this is Gina's home. Oh, it's delightful to have her back and have someone so warm and gay and alive in the house. Miss Marple nodded and looked out of the window again at the two young people standing near the lake. They're a remarkably handsome couple, too, she said. I don't wonder Gina fell in love with them. Oh, but that isn't Wally. There was quite suddenly a touch of embarrassment or restraint in Mrs. Sericold's voice. Oh, that's Steve, the younger of Johnny Resterick's two boys. When he went away, he'd no place for the boys in the holidays, so I always had them here. They look on this as their home, and Steve's here permanently now. He runs our dramatic branch. We have a theater, you know, and plays. We encourage all the artistic instincts. Lewis says that so much of this juvenile crime is due to exhibitionism. Most of the boys have had such thwarted, unhappy home life, and these hold-ups and burglaries make them feel heroes. Well, we urge them to write their own plays and act in them and design and paint their own scenery. Steve is in charge of the theater. He's so keen and enthusiastic. It's wonderful what life he's put into the whole thing. I see, said Miss Marple slowly. Her long-distance sight was good, as many of her neighbours knew to their cost in the village of St. Mary Mead, and she saw very clearly the dark, handsome face of Stephen Resterick as he stood facing Gina, talking eagerly. Gina's face she could not see, since the girl had her back to them, but there was no mistaking the expression in Stephen Resterick's face. "It isn't any business of mine," said Miss Marple, "but I suppose you realize, Carrie Louise, that he's in love with her."
"Oh, no." Carrie Louise looked troubled. "Oh, no. I do hope not."
"You were always up in the clouds, Carrie Louise. There's not the least doubt about it." Chapter 4. Before Mrs. Serico could say anything, her husband came in from the hall carrying some open letters in his hand. Louis Sericold was a short man, not particularly impressive in appearance, but with a personality that immediately marked him out. Ruth had once said of him that he was more like a dynamo than a human being. He usually concentrated entirely on what was immediately occupying his attention and paid no attention to the objects or persons who were surrounding them. "A bad blow, dearest," he said. "That boy, Jackie Flint, back at his tricks again. And I really did think he meant to go straight this time if he got a proper chance. He was most earnest about it. You know, we found he'd always been keen on railways, and both Maverick and I thought that if he got a job on the railways, he'd stick to it and make good. But it's the same story. Petty thieving from the parcels office, not even stuff he could want or sell. That shows it must be psychological. We haven't really got to the root of the trouble. But I'm not giving up. Louis, this is my old friend Jane Marple." "Oh, how do you do?" said Mr. Sericold, absently. "So glad. They'll prosecute, of course. Nice lad, too. Not too many brains, but a really nice boy. Unspeakable home he came from. He suddenly broke off, and the dynamo was switched on to the guest. "Why, Miss Marple, I'm so delighted you've come to stay with us for a while. It will make a great difference to Caroline to have a friend of old days with whom she can exchange memories. She has in many ways a grim time here. So much sadness in the stories of these poor children. We do hope you'll stay with us for a very long time." Miss Marple felt the magnetism and realized how attractive it would have been to her friend. That Louis Sericold was a man who would always put causes before people she did not doubt for a moment. It might have irritated some women, but not Carrie Louise. Louis Sericold sorted out another letter. "At any rate, we've some good news. This is from the Wiltshire and Somerset Bank. Young Morris is doing extremely well. They're thoroughly satisfied with him, and in fact are promoting him next month. I always knew that all he needed was responsibility. That, and a thorough grasp of the handling of money, and what it means." He turned to Miss Marple. "Half these boys don't know what money is. It represents to them going to the pictures or to the dogs or buying cigarettes, and they're clever with figures and find it exciting to juggle them round. Well, I believe in, what shall I say, rubbing their noses in the stuff. Train them in accountancy and figures. Show them the whole inner romance of money, so to speak. Give them skill and then responsibility. Let them handle it officially. Our greatest successes have been that way. Only 2 out of 38 have let us down. One's a head cashier in a firm of druggists, a really responsible position." He broke off to say, "Tea's in, dearest," to his wife. "Well, I thought we were having it in here. I told Jolly." "No, it's in the hall. The others are there." "I thought they were all going to be out." Carrie Louise linked her arm through Miss Marple's, and they went into the great hall. Tea seemed a rather incongruous meal in its surroundings. The tea things were piled haphazard on a tray, white utility cups mixed with the remnants of what had been Rockingham and Spode tea services. There was a loaf of bread, 2 pots of jam, and some cheap and unwholesome-looking cakes. A plump, middle-aged woman with grey hair sat behind the tea table, and Mrs. Sericold said, "Oh, this is Mildred, Jane, my daughter Mildred. You haven't seen her since she was a tiny girl." Mildred Street was the person most in tune with the house that Miss Marple had so far seen. She looked prosperous and dignified. She had married late in her 30s, a canon of the Church of England, and was now a widow. She looked exactly like a canon's widow, respectable and slightly dull. She was a plain woman with a large, unexpressive face and dull eyes. She had been, Miss Marple reflected, a very plain little girl. "And this is Wally Hurd, Gina's husband." Now, Wally was a big young man with hair brushed up on his head and a sulky expression. He nodded awkwardly and went on cramming cake into his mouth. Presently, Gina came in with Stephen Resterick. They were both very animated. "Gina's got a wonderful idea for that backcloth," said Stephen. "You know, Gina, you've got a very definite flair for theatrical designing." Gina laughed and looked pleased. Edgar Lawson came in and sat down by Louis Sericold. When Gina spoke to him, he made a pretense of not answering. Miss Marple found it all a little bewildering and was glad to go to her room and lie down after tea. There were more people still at dinner. A young Dr. Maverick, who was either a psychiatrist or a psychologist, Miss Marple was rather hazy about the difference, and whose conversation, dealing almost entirely with the jargon of his trade, was practically unintelligible to her. There were also two spectacled young men who held posts on the teaching side, and a Mr. Baumgarten, who was an occupational therapist, and three intensely bashful youths who were doing their house guest week. One of them, a fair-haired lad with very blue eyes, was, Gina informed her in a whisper, the expert with the cosh. The meal was not a particularly appetizing one. It was indifferently cooked and indifferently served. A variety of costumes were worn. Miss Bellever wore a high black dress, Mildred Street wore evening dress and a woolen cardigan over it. Carrie Louise had on a short dress of grey wool. Gina was resplendent in a kind of peasant get-up. Wally had not changed, nor had Stephen Resterick. Edgar Lawson had on a neat dark blue suit. Louis Sericold wore the conventional dinner jacket. He ate very little and seemed hardly to notice what was on his plate.